So anyway, I think George is going to speak first, so I'll just hand over to you, George.
Okay, thank you very much. A minute ago, when he introduced me, I said, yeah, I'll throw an out of there, that university. I've never done that before. You know, when you give a paper at a conference, you don't usually, with a small triumphant smile, disclose the fact that you were thrown out of the university, you know, particularly when that's where your job is. But somehow it just seemed right for this audience. So I hope you'll bear with me. When we were over having lunch, I was looking one way at everyone eating and talking about punk rock, and then my eye was caught from looking out the windows at the other end, because there's a lovely view of some allotments there, and I was thinking about allotments and slow culture and the radicalism of community gardening and those different other ways of thinking about process and having cultures and alternative radical cultures, which I wrote about in Radical Garden, which is this book here. The one thing I didn't like about it was it's got a gun next to my name. And I had a big argument with the press actually about that. I said in the current orthodoxy of militarism in which we live, I do not want a gun next to my name on the book cover. And They said they talked about it at length, and then they did it anyway. And then when the book came out, my daughter said, "Hey, cool cover." So you know, maybe for an older generation it didn't work. My new book, Shaken All Over, is out in a few months. It's called Popular Music and Disability. I've got a few of these little flyers here, which has got a natty cat on there from a punk rocker who's in a wheelchair and he's got no heat and he's drinking a can. So if anyone wants one, please take them. If you don't, just pass them along and so on. There is a bit about punk rock in that book, Crips and Sweet, CCT, their stars, and anti-dancing. This is the book that I first wrote about Krasin, and it came out in 1996, Centre of Back to Beauty, Cultures of Resistance since the 60s, and in it, originally in fact, I was writing and thinking about this book 20 years ago now, and I finished my PhD and I was thinking, oh, do I want to do postmodern literature and utopia, and then I just, I can't do any more of that, I'm never going to read another novel again in my entire life. Yes, the PhD and MS put me off novel reading, and I've never read a novel since. And then one day, I think it was Black Wednesday, you know, when Norman Lamont and there was the financial crisis, I suddenly thought, God, capitalism is failing all around us. And then, and I've got to give this paper on Saturday on postmodernism and literature. I'm not going to do it on that. I'm going to do it on postmodernism and crass and anarchism. And I tried to sort of merge this thing together, which didn't work. It was a failure. But it was the beginning of my interest in revisiting my own political biography and my own sense of alternative culture, and it took me down a different path, which I still sort of explore today in my own writing. Originally, Senseless Act of Beauty was a book about Crass. I had this idea, I proposed in 6 chapters. In my mind, the band, when did you split? 1984? Yeah, 84, you know, and it seemed such a long time then, and it seemed as though Crass had just disappeared from the landscape. And what struck me as a major achievement and a major set of texts, records, and all the other stuff we've been talking about today, had just got lost. And that seemed to me to have gone on forever, okay. Even though when I look back, it was about 6 or 7 years. But at the time, that was a very, very long 6 or 7 years. And so I wanted to write this book about Crass. I sent it off to a publisher at Verso, which was then, probably still is, at this crisis, leading left-wing publishing house in the UK. And usually you send a proposal to Verso and nothing ever happens. But the next day the phone rang. I said, oh, hi, it's Malcolm here from Verso. He said, yeah, you sent me this proposal on Crass. He said, great idea, I'm not going to do it. We're not having that. And that's too narrow, it won't sell. And, but why don't you do me a bigger book about the alternative movement of the 1990s related back to the 60s and put Crass in the middle of it, you know? And so that's where the book came from, really. And that is what I did. In order to make those links between, say, the Free Festival movement and punk rock, or between free festivals and free parties, or between Greenham Common and the road protest of the 1990s, also in Barcelona, just a few miles down the road, I looked for a few figures that seemed to be cross-generationally important, and then I tried, if I could find them, to contact them and interview them, speak to them about They worked in two different generations, so they were in two different eras, in the 60s and the 70s, the 70s and the 90s or whatever. And one of those, was in my mind, was the back penny. And so I contacted him, and we discussed things from there. And of course, he was very supportive and very, very friendly. I wrote quite a lot in that book about the bean field as well, which came up earlier. What I've got today, I was just thinking, I was on the train this morning coming here, and I thought I'd better listen to a bit of Crash, because it's been a while, and so I put it on, but I've been up since 6 o'clock, so I did that for a while. And then when I woke up, we were coming into England, it was on Eurostar, we were coming into England, and I woke up just as the lights came up out of the tunnel in Kent, or wherever it comes up. And there was something like, "The Bastards!" Right? And I thought, "Oh, geez, I'm in England again." And this brought back to me a little bit of that memory of power and the way that music Hitler spoke to me as a young punk, I suppose. I was about 17 or 18 in the late 70s. Yeah, sort of this was 1977, so I was 16 then, I think. Right, I've got these letters. I'm going to read from them. And partly it's because I found these, I used one of these letters a few years ago, but I knew there were two or three of them, and they were letters that come to me from different members of CRAS that I, in response to stuff, I must have written to them at the time. And I thought, oh, that will be hopefully quite interesting, because you'll perhaps get a glimpse of this earnest, young, critical, attitudinal boy in Norfolk trying to make a connection, to help get someone to help them to explore ideas and stuff like that. And also we might see a little bit about Crass and little short snapshots of them at different periods in their trajectory. And in fact, there are four of these letters. I've forgotten. There were four. So, here goes. This is after the Feeding of the 5,000 was released, and I must have written to them, and then they wrote back. "Dear George, thank you for the letter. I enclosed a copy of the paper we produced. Hope you like it. I'm sorry you thought the record was expensive. We put as much material on it, right? You know these records that said pay no more, and I'm right to complain that it's expensive." Sorry. "We put as much material on it as most bands put on an LP at twice the price. Most people have thought it really good value. Oh well. We may try the Boogie House, right, which is a sort of commercial venue in Norwich. I was wanting to come to Norwich, so I can see them. It used to be a punk club, and then it reopened as a more rock space, hence that terrible name, the Boogie House. Though generally, we're not too keen on playing straight commercial gigs. We prefer to do benefits, but we'll get to Norwich eventually, somehow. I find a lot of Feeding of the 5,000 a bit moderate now. At the time we were pleased with it, but inevitably much of it now sounds thin. I'm sorry you find women contrived. I don't think it is. It was recorded live and isn't played around at all. You probably won't like the new recording we've done of Asylum for the same reason. We're hoping to get it pressed ourselves. We want to get it out on record because what it said matters to us. Fuck comes up a lot because I suppose that's the way we speak. It wasn't fabricated, honest. Anyway, thanks for the letter and the interest. Hope we see you in Norwich sometime. Penny Randall." So here's the second letter. I was obviously encouraged, I didn't. I wasn't Val Wilmer. You know Val Wilmer, the jazz photographer and historian, spent a lot of time writing letters to New Orleans and jazz in the 50s. He would go on to international, to go to a post office, a large one in London, and go and look up names, and eventually she would find, Sonny Williams, New Orleans, such an address or something like that, and then she would write him a letter, and eventually she would let it write back. I didn't do that. I only wrote to Crass and one other artist, I think. September 1979. "Dear George, many thanks for the word. I thought they were very beautiful. And almost tender in places, a bit like our stuff. Brackets. I hope that doesn't sound too emotional." I don't know what I mean. "In your letter, you ask if we ever play in the provinces." This came up earlier. Well, we do. We're trying to confirm a date at Tracy's Night Spot in Ipswich at the moment. Whoa. So it might not be too long before you see us after all. The new records should be out in about 4 to 5 weeks' time. Yes, I do believe in anarchy, personal anarchy. I suppose if a super tough bloke or woman came along, we'd have each other to turn to. I think I must have been asking them about what would happen, if you were a pacifist in some violent situation and you didn't really know how you would handle it and so on. Well, I don't really have an answer to that, except to try to on my app, but nowadays. That's the anarchy I want. When people see themselves as individuals and start respecting others and themselves, this is underlined, as human beings. When people start living on a basis of love and trust rather than hate and suspicion, that's anarchy. Everything you say about Van is true. I totally agree with you. I must have gone off on one. I was so shocked when I saw the proposed cover of the Slits record, them standing there showing their tits. And of course everyone will buy the fucking thing, a lot of them only for that cover. Sickening, isn't it? But as long as there are people like you and us, there is always hope. See Yer, YDR, Love and Anarchy, Steve Ignorant. P.S. and don't worry, we won't ever be led. P.P.S. I don't think we've got street cred, have we? What is it anyway? In fact, the Slits were talking over, the lab of Alton was talking about that album just the other day, recovering when they made the recording stuff. Right, okay. His third letter came from after in fact Crass played in Norwich the same year, 1979, the first time, I don't know. And so it was at the barn in Sherry, Jimmy, do you know him? He was the editor of Anarchist Studies for a while, I don't know if it's Gordon or someone like that, University. He was one of the organisers, he was a student at the UEA at the time, he was one of the organisers of this gig. And it was originally a Poison Girls gig, and I think Crass came on as a late support, surprise. And word went round that they were going to come. So UEA, 1979. And then before I read from that letter, I've just got a retrospective memoir that I included in Fenceless Attitude of my own about that gig. Just as punk was dead, along came real serious believers like I was. Not like me at all. Seriously earnest folks, intimidatingly serious in looks and rhetoric, singing songs like Punk is Dead. At the UEA barn I stumbled across them. They weren't even on the bill. Sometime in 79, near the end of the year. We knew about Crass from the Feeding of the 5,000. I'd even written to them. But it wasn't until that night that we knew they'd be playing too. Not too sure, even then. Was it a benefit gig for Freewheel, the radical bookshop on St. Benedict's? I still have a poster somewhere which caught my eye from being so small and difficult to read. Rough red screen print with thick ink on rough black paper. It featured intriguing slogans and totems. Anarch for you too, a flying bird with talons against a circular backdrop. It was contemporary and flaunted that. The admission price was 79 pence in 1979. I like that the price and the money aspect of this anarchist event was so rooted to the date. It made it somehow less capitalistically important, just an arbitrary contemporary necessity which could as easily be gone tomorrow. That first time in Norwich, Crass was startling. Not just to me, but to all the punks who knew about the gig and had turned up. All the more so because they, the band, were so casual about it, wandering around the half-empty hall before and after playing, waiting for us to talk with them, drinking tea. Music was material to Crass, and they showed that. The performance was an object, clearly delineated, which they involved themselves in, and then exited. Music happened for a while, and then it didn't happen. Even a post-punk art group like Wire, that we'd all seen at the old punk club in Norwich, the night they didn't throw a tank at the audience, didn't manage to subvert the performance process in the way that Crass did. Looking at it from the other direction, Crass didn't so much cut short in a material way the performance as extended entirely and indefinitely to include the pre- and post-show, the setting up of the look-like-homemade PA, the draping of flags and banners and subsequent transformation of the barn, the venue, the being looked at in their problematically paramilitary black garb and red armbands, the sexy, sexless women. Either way, I was totally intimidated and deeply attracted. Here were people doing exactly what I thought punk should do, take itself seriously, be considered as a force, a creative possibility to destroy. Brackets, Bakunin vivified. Though in their early days, someone said this earlier, Crass said they thought Bakunin was a kind of rock. For Norfolk people, it was a bit like a set of alien beings dropped into our cosy country context from some other place that ran on different rules that breathed authenticity. There was no joy with Crass. It was the fostering of puzzlement. Norwich punks were bewildered. We weren't expecting this. I knew in an instant that Crass was something special and, more importantly, something serious, a new shard of punk. The shock of that first single too, I am no feeble Christ, offered in an intensely righteous way, a clearly spoken rhetoric that blurs words, coupled with a frenetic delivery of the repeated, in all your decadence, people die. On the other side, that's the side I listen to. That the doubtful only of the cheap drama of rail track sound effects that suggest the Holocaust. The cover too signals difference, rough brown cardboard with staples and tight lyrics, red and black graphics, industrial grade paper insert, mysterious symbols, slogans and coded numbers. So I've gone to the gig, and then going to the gig has blown my mind, and then I've gone back to look in more detail at the records that have been produced. Then I wrote them a letter, and then they wrote back. Dear George, thanks for the letter. 26th of November 1979. Complicated, comprehensive, sensitive, committed, and only slightly self-effacing. It's rare that we get letters where we aren't just expected to trot out a few pleasantries and send a badge, please. Perhaps I'll just go through and write as I come to please. Our appearance. Well, it's been about the same for about a year now, and so are most of the actual clothes. Our clothes might be the right ones in Norwich, which I find slightly and illogically refreshing, but in London, we look like a bunch of well-tended rag bags. So I suppose it's over for you to sort out. We're not velvet zippies, we're not the system. Our performance. A large part of what the band can do is point out or even give a small indication of the way things are going. Our stage appearance, which is assumed, considered, but not contrived, is a charade of what people might have to deal with in 5, 10, 15 years' time. There isn't aggression in our performance, it's desperation. Usually we play in places where a large part of the audience are self-confessed misfits. Punks, skins, NF, National Front, BM, British Movement, SWP, hippies, freaks, anarchists, and no matter how bigoted they might be in their own particular sensitive areas, they are still open, if we can put it right, to ideas. They openly admit, after all, that they are looking. Their commitment to the system, to the way things are done, continuing, isn't complete. The giggles at the UEA, I must have mentioned this. I was thinking about being a student at the time. The university is total system. All or most of the people there have a commitment to it going on, college course, job. They will go along with what we do to the extent that they can be unaffected by it. It's fun. I think that if the people from the town hadn't come, we would have either not played or have gone over the top. I think Steve came close to going over the top. That's why we don't usually play in colleges since the early days when we were pissed anyway. We played Chelsea Art School. The only way I could express my disgust at the place was by pissing on a Henry Moore sculpture outside the front door, which is pretty futile. Encourage, provoke, intimidate, violence. I must have mentioned these as a small general accusation. We don't instill violence. At best, we confront the individuals in the audience with their own violence, prejudice, in a relatively safe environment, as safe as we can make it. Ideas again. If the individual wants to deal with it, he or she can in their own time. You seem to be making an attempt to understand yourself. I suspect that's the only thing really worth the effort to try and understand. Trying to understand Christ. I think it's possible to see anything in the band. Fascists, wimps, fools, stars. Well, the SS has the arse hanging out this crisis. And the audience reaction, well, they were having to put up with being in a stupid fucking college too. And afterwards, people did ask us for badges, autographs, etc. And, short of autographs, we try and give people what they ask for. But if someone asks for a badge, they get our badge, anarchy and peace with the A breaking the gun, and that's loaded. Sooner or later, they might try and come to terms with the symbol they've been wearing for 2 weeks or so. Apparently, there's a badge attached here to the letter paper. Eve sang, in all your decadence, and in all our decadence. To understand what we're doing, to have thought about what we're doing, is us taking responsibility for what we do. I don't think that's superficial. We don't get off on playing. We don't particularly like putting ourselves up there in what, in London at least, seem to be heavier and heavier situations. And if we don't know what we're doing or haven't considered things, then the audience is exposed. The way we do handouts, record covers, etc., smacks of care and DIY. One of the nicest things about gigs increasingly is the number of people turning up who are doing things of their own. A sort of loose network slowly built up and information gets around. And you get a sense there that this is a development, you know, that not necessarily a plan. We don't only hand out badges at gigs, we get to meet and chat with quite a few people. It's a pity we didn't get to talk to you, I was intimidated. Bit of a weighty letter this. Perhaps if you come and see us at the gig some other time, it's so much easier talking than writing. I'm enclosing a copy of Toxic Graffiti, just for the hell of it. See you. Anarchy and Peace, Peace, Right. Okay, so then, I go to university, I get chucked out, I end up in college next door, and I'm in the anarchist group in Harvard. And to my despair, one, I think it was in Freedom, said, Hull anarchist group is one of the leading, you know, most active groups in the country, because to me, from within, we were just a bunch of dysfunctional idiots, we could barely speak to each other. And then, but nonetheless, and there was a sort of split between the direct action movement, syndicalists, the kind of 60s, late 60s, early 70s, hippies, and then the punk Puritans, and the policy of the punk Puritans. And then Kraft came to play in Hull one night, but by then, things had moved on. And in fact, the Hull anarchist group leafleted the gig. It was at a commercial venue called the Tower, and it was a commercial live music space. I was surprised that Kraft played them. And then by then we were part of that dissatisfaction with what Kraft were doing, and I sort of got caught up in although I was from the punk perspective, I got rather caught up in the pure sort of syndicalist direct action movement thing that was rather dominant in our group. And we leafleted with, I think, a leaflet which was critical of anarcho-punk press. And we gave them all out to the punks who were going to the gig. They all just got chucked on the floor. Dear George, sorry this letter. Oh, sorry, I must have written to press after that. And I probably even included a copy of our leaflet, you know, just so they knew that I was cross and critical of that. Dear George, sorry this letter is a bit late in the day. This is about 1981 or 82. We are finding keeping up with all the letters we receive is very difficult, especially since we believe that every letter must have a personal reply. I'm sorry your experience at the Tower was so negative. The person who arranged the gig for us was very straightforward. The door price was added at all our gigs, and the people who worked there were incredibly helpful. But I guess there's always something not right, and obviously any place we play has its other side, and all we can do is make it as good a place to be for the one evening we occupy with ourselves and our ideas. Every place of entertainment. Canvas to the boredom and depression of youth, stroke anyone, stroke people, and as long as bored people depend on someone else to provide entertainment, those places will take advantage of negativity. I hope when we put on a gig, we go beyond entertainment. I hope we offer possibilities and practical alternatives to the commercial crap that's just dished out like a sedative, disrespectfully and self-interested. When we do gigs, we try to demonstrate that working together and sharing our lives and ideas is the alternative which will make us independent, us being all, you, me, etc., from the greedy businessmen, the warmongers, the takers, and greeders of hate. Thank you for your support and the copy of the whole Anarchist Group magazine. It's called Angry, with a ring around the A, yeah. With love and peace from Joy, and good greetings to whole Anarchist Group. And those are my sort of personal documents from Kraft. And I wanted to finish with two observations, really. One is to go back to the almost the very beginning. And because I was struck when Anna, was it Anna? Your paper. And then you have some quotations from Punk is Dead, something like that. There. And one of the things that I think was really, really powerful about Kraft, especially in those early lyrics, was precisely the lyrics, their everyday nature, and the way in which they seemed to speak a different sort of language to even that which was being spoken in other punk music at the time, or and especially in pop music. And I'll just give two instances of that, right? And they signaled to me a real confidence and imagination, creativity, and on the part of Kraft, even if, you know, that wasn't necessarily a conscious one. It was sort of intuitive, or just a way to get an authentic voice. You know, and if you think of a song like Punk Is Dead, what really struck me as soon as I first heard it, as a 17-year-old punk rocker, and I'm thinking, just found it, and that's it. And then, it's just got to Norwich, and now London says it's dead, great. what really strikes about that song is the first line. Yes, that's right, punk is dead. No. That's such a great line, and I was so struck by that as a 17-year-old, right? The song's called Punk Is Dead, and then the first line is, yes, that's right, Like it's this, you know. It knew, the song, the lyric was aware of the power of the title, that it wasn't just a slogan and that it was a confrontation. And then the lyric included and commented on the confrontation and the antagonistic critical position that was in its own song part. I thought that was so clever, you know, as a young lad. I thought it was so direct, marvelous. And then the second thing, on the same album, was that Feed Another 5,000?
Yeah.
Was on the song Security Kid. Security Corps, and then you know, Security Corps gave the shit out of you. And there was a line I think in that song where whoever sang it, and we said, "Well, tough shit, because I'm moving." And well, you never really quite had that, you know, that simple direct statement or everyday spoken language. "Well, tough shit, because I'm moving." In a song lyric form. And again, that really, really grabbed me as that boy. And I'd come through the Pistols and all of that, the Clash, and all the other punk thing. But there was something direct and everyday in the technical, lyrical language of Christ, which was lyrical, both in the sense that these were song lyrics, and it was lyrical in the sense that, you know, it was trying that word working thing of everyday language, you know. And that is a powerful aspect, I think, of their effort and their achievement. And then my final point is, some people were talking about the relevance of Crass today. It seems to me, I was looking at one of the records we've done today, it's called the record for the time. Happened not to have, I think. And it showed an image of like someone like a soldier with a gun sitting, leaning on a tree, and then one leg stretched out, and then the other leg is a missile. Okay. And so, you know, sort of disabled, prosthetic disabled, and so on. And I was looking at that earlier and thinking, wow, that's really terrific. Because that the extraordinary power and relevance of Crass, to me, rests in that radical and uncompromising rejection, critique and rejection of the military machine. And that our culture of war, which is inescapable in our contemporary society, even more so than it was in the 1980s, even though we were under the cloud of nuclear sublime then, you know. Our heroes, our disabled heroes, are our soldiers, you know. And then, so if you work in disability culture, it's very, very difficult to get through that. And we're in a constant, as I said earlier, we're an orthodoxy of militarism in contemporary Western society. And it seems to me that what is most powerful and telling and relevant about Crass is that uncompromising critique of militarism and of war machine. And you know, while at the time I would slightly stand back on and think, yeah, but that's just over the top conspiracy and so on. And even while I was on demonstrations thinking the world could end at any moment if some mad bastard in Russia was at the state pressing the button. I don't feel it's a conspiracy. I feel that the kind of the sense of the systematic, orthodox, militaristic culture and celebration and inescapable engagement and acceptance of war is such a feature of our contemporary society, and that is something precious and important, that a critique of that, an uncompromising critique of that, is something precious and important that Crass could still offer. Thank you.
Well, as promised, I hope, you know, we didn't have the chance for people to ask specific questions to George because of the time constraint. Then I'm going to take the chair's privilege and ask a quick one myself, and then we'll see if anyone else has one, if that's all right. Something which actually, because I was really interested in what you just said about, it was Verzo who suggested not just about the rattle about Crass, but taking this along with a view, which is one of the things I particularly like about Senseless Acts of Beauty, that it seems to tie up a long period of history in a way that I find very persuasive. I also really like what you say in Circular Breathing about trying jazz and seeing the intro and those links, and in the DIY Arting Process book where you edited and but I think in your foreword and in the collection of essays it shows the interesting links between often to music or music-related cultures, plus free parties and things, for example, and the radical culture of the 90s. So it's just quite a sort of different periods, and Crass there, but obviously being very in an archetype, being very affecting to you personally in that period when you were a particular age. I wonder, you know, how much do you think that there is new cultures of resistance in the 21st century? Is it important, the cultures of resistance, that they are tied to a sort of novelty or particular kind of cultural situation in a period? I'm thinking of something. I just finished a short Noam Chomsky thing about Occupy, Penguin, which is done for a fiver, which is worth looking at. And, you know, this Occupy seems to be tied to a sort of music culture, which maybe is interesting. It's really kind of street, say. It's felt like it's sort of tied in a way to, it's really common in a way related to Crass and so on. I wonder if you've got a response to that.
Yeah, well, I suppose what I've done in the last few years is I've moved away from something that might be perceived as cool. You know, I've just got less interested in stuff that was cool, and often music has that, or was that, or rejects it, but secretly wishes it had it, and so on. Popular music, I mean, or lots of kinds of popular music, and there's an ethos of leading edge or cutting edgeness about things, and I didn't want a cutting edge. I wanted an aesthetic, or critical aesthetic, bluntness, but I didn't know what that meant, and I don't know what it means either. But what in practice it meant critically was that's why I did a book about garden, right? Because I just wanted to get away from scenes and music and new generations of activists taking things on and being sort of, and effectively beginning to rather repeat a cyclical narrative rather than, you know, what I was trying to do is not just say here's a bit, here's a bit, here's a bit, but to make connections across the decades between different movements. But then after a while of doing that, I suppose when I've done my Glastonbury book too, because that was about sort of more commercial end of festivals in relationship to Stonehenge, but the more commercial end, I sort of start glimpsing a kind of music which was more commercially oriented, and I didn't want to do that. I did the jazz book, and of course jazz is cool even though there's no money in it, and I mean, or it has this, even though it's sort of dead at the right time. And then, funnily enough, I was at a jazz conference yesterday, right? And then they were all about 15 years older than you. And then, although there were some black people there as well, and then about the same amount of women, i.e. not many, but less tattoos. And then, but there, the sort of jazz studies got interesting about 30 or 40 years after jazz had died. And maybe that's what's happening with anarcho-punk studies as well, or something like that, you know. After it's had its prime creative moment, a few decades later, the music comes in. So I did the gardening, the critical writing about the music comes in. I did gardening to shift from, you know, anything that could perceivably be considered as subcultural or having some sort of subcultural cachet or authority or power or coolness or style or anything like that. And I wanted to do something altogether more mundane and dirty and slow and less mediated, and to move away from the trashy ephemeral world of pop in its many manifestations. So I've done that's really a motivation for the gardening book. And I'd also just say with the disability book that comes out, although there is it's a book about music, it's not really a book so much, except the last chapter about the politics of music, and music as a campaign tool for disability social movements, say. Something more about the representation, the exploration, the claiming, and the cripping of pop by those disabled artists who work within it. And so again, there's a bit of a shifting away from politics there. I was a bit surprised actually when I did the garden book that I wrote it. I've been thinking about it and talking about it for 10 years, and then it all sort of came together. I wrote it very quickly, and I was surprised because I sensed myself moving away from obvious sort of politics, culture, work, which is where I've been for, you know, most of my academic career. And I wanted to move away to look at more, to consider in more textual, critical understanding the way in which culture is formed and expressed. And by that I mean, you know, close readings of popular music songs, for example, rather than the accretion of things around them and the way in which they look outside the music themselves. I want to look more into the music. So I was surprised that I ended up writing about gardening and politics, because it took me back to my own familiar territory.
It's amazing how many people from the anarcho-punk scene ended up sort of interested in permaculture.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
yeah.
I was delighted to hear a bit about the Hull Anarchist Group, how you moved from enthusiastic anarcho-punk to anarcho-punk cynic, and that's kind of a personal friend of mine, had that exact same experience, and recounted it to me, and I was sort of shocked. Anarchism and punk go hand in hand, how can you be against this when your entire civilization is built upon? And he didn't really recognize that, he still holds that view. I imagine that you've moved past that kind of sectarian point of view, but I wonder how that situation developed and how you reconciled your way out of it, if at all.
I never thought of it as sectarian, actually. And I would never have described it like that, but I've seen all of them. When I say see, that means I disagree, it's polite. And then, well, I'll tell you where I went with it. When I did the Circle of Reason, the book about jazz, politics of jazz and Britain, I spent a lot of time writing about free improvisation and the free scenes from the 60s and early 70s, and I interviewed a lot of musicians from there, and lots of them had been anarchists, more of them than communists, in fact. The British musicians, lots of them, the car-carrying communist party members. And then all the other various leftist parties, SWP, WRP, and so on, lots of them involved in that. So there was this, you know, amazing collection of experimental music, new music, sounds that had never been made before in quite that way, and then with a radical politics at the time. And when I interviewed Maggie Nichols, the Sweden provider, vocalist, she's been around for 40 years, fabulous player, and then performer. And when I interviewed her, I asked her about her links with the punk scene in the 70s, you know, because that was where anarchism got really strong, and she'd always been interested in anarchist ideas. Those who come through the separatist feminist movement, come out the other side of that, so on, so all this stuff going on in their background. And her comment was the trouble with the anarchists was that they were too focused on punk rock music, and they were culturally uncurious, can you say that? They weren't curious about music, you know. They didn't have an ear for different kinds of music. They weren't interested in the expression and the exploration of sonic possibilities that her and her three improvisers were trying out in different ways. And the punk had a very, in her view, this was her response, had a very pure and fixed sort of version of what cultural radicalism could be in musical terms, and that simply wasn't enough for her. So unless she sympathised tremendously with anarchist ideas, in cultural terms she saw it as rather reactionary, aggressive, and very, very limited, you know. And that, you know, I had different interviews and said all of that, and I thought, you know, and then I'm sitting there mulling that over, because that's a bit of a bombshell going off in my head, being a jabber and an ex-punk rocker who's interested in anarchism and just told the car off was crap, you know. And then, I sort of, well, what do I listen to? Do I listen to an anarcho punk? No. In fact, probably you today, first time for some years I've listened to that movie. Do I listen to experimental jazz? Do I go and see someone start at listening to free jazz? But would I go and see a good free jazz band? Yes, obviously. So that probably is perhaps an answer to you. My sectarianism or my relationship with an anarcho punk has taken me in a different direction, because I just don't think it doesn't musically stimulate me. I don't find it musically interesting.
I think a probably a final point there, George, about this increasing militarism of society that we see today. And given the fact that, you know, the anarchists we're looking at today was so fascinating, and, you know, being a challenge to this, you know, wanton destruction and lust for war. Given the fact that, as you rightly point out, it's much, much worse today, why are we not seeing such an uprising and an uproar? I mean, I'm to be corrected, and the founders of the War Coalition, and there are people who are, you know, doing very good work, but it seems to me that largely from within the cultural scene, the arts in general, and the academy, it's just mute acceptance. Why might that be?
Is it mute acceptance?
No.
When we were talking about the things that are now being respected, we emptied one. It's as simple as that. But if you're touching with nerve, no one wants to listen, for very obvious reason. And people are touching the nerve now, just as they ever were. Possibly this time round it's not quite so exploitable. Maybe people have learned better, I don't know what it is. But the idea that, you know, dissent has died, quite simply because there are, I don't actually think that the, I always forget its name in order to be American movement, the mentioning Occupy, I don't think that represents anything comparable with what was happening in, you know, the golden age of punk, for example. That was a moment in history where that sort of action worked. And there was great potential, and if we didn't push it through, we couldn't push it through. That's another subject which maybe we'll get onto. But it was working. To try and apply that now and say, oh, well, nothing's happening. Well, of course it isn't, because it's not talking the right language. You know, things have changed, and we haven't changed with them. We're still thinking we can approach, and that's why I really don't like that sort of retro punk thing. What's that about? Talking about something that was actually happening 30 years ago, as if somehow that's pertinent. I mean, it's absolutely correct. I think someone mentioned that, yes, their right will is as pertinent today as it was then. It's more pertinent. But I'm not, the last thing in the world I'd ever do is get up and perform it. It's there, it's been done, like the Bible was done. You know, it's finished. You know, and if we're not looking for equally radical and self-confronting aspects, then yes, it's all finished, but I know I am, you know, which is why I'm so emphatic about saying no, but I'm the only person on earth who is. Well, that's fine, it's good enough for me. And that has to be good enough for us.
Yeah,
not me doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Your point was also, it wasn't so much that there isn't dissent, it was that there's seeming not to be cultural expressions of that dissent being caught at the same time.
Yeah. The thing that we've been reviewing today was like nationwide, yeah. In the UK, was nationwide, you go to any town, you can find, you know, dozens of bands, lots of people shouting about, you know, what the time, what threatened the actual war. But here we are now in this era of, naked imperialism, if you look at Iraq, and this burgeoning neo-colonialism, neo-imperialism in Libya, Syria, and no doubt soon Iran. We'll actually get the speed of war. You know, it's rampant. It's only last week I was on the streets of Sheffield, pedestrian art precincts, just full of armed forces, RAF, Navy, every wing of the military was there on the streets, help the heroes, you know, all kind of thing. And I don't know what I'm expecting to see, but this commodification of the military, ramming it down our throats, is very worrying. And I just do not see the response that we ought to see. It's just an acceptance of that the way we do business.
Well, I mean, is the response to expect to see some, you know, rather naive kid shouting at that group of people you saw in Sheffield, having his head beaten in and probably spending the next 3 weeks under surveillance? What do you expect to see? Or do you expect to see someone like myself, dressed in a herringbone jacket, partly getting on with their own life, looking for new ways around it? Because that's what you're not seeing.
Well, I think
there's probably more intelligent consideration now. I mean, I think the one thing Occupy possibly did do is create, you know, networks out of which will develop some radical thought. Certainly in itself, it was not radical, it was, you know, quite reactionary, I think. You know, it was a very middle-class way of going about things, or rather nice and polite, which was the safe thing to do, I think it was safe as it can be now. But the idea that nothing's happening is absurd. I mean, very clearly, and it's very clear in the beauty of people's faces, in the silence.
I wonder whether it's I've done the well, yeah, okay, but I have to believe it isn't the same as it being the case for those. I mean, actually, that betrays a sort of certain potentially desperate position, doesn't it? We have to believe that, otherwise, we're
No, it didn't. It actually it portrays an attitude that unless we believe it, how can we create it?
Mm. Okay. I wonder whether music just isn't quite as interesting. We live in a town, you know, there's a whole debate about post-ideology and stuff like that. It's been there for 20 years, you know, and if we're in a post-ideological world where, you know, Western democracy has won, we don't need to fight those struggles anymore, and everybody keeps telling us that all the time. And the more people tell us that, the more difficult it also is to overcome, because that gets such a people to be such a dominant position. So I wonder whether that's part of it, and there's not such a stark oppositional culture or set of sides being taken, positions being taken, us and them, as there were in critical moments in British history in the past, say like the miners' strike of 72-4, the miners' strike of 84-5, stuff like that. And then with, on both occasions actually, with the hippie movements in relation to festivals being coming under attack as a sort of secondary enemy within kind of thing, both in 74 and in 85. That might be something to do with it. I wonder as well whether maybe music just, you know, the radical cultural element moves elsewhere and music isn't always going to be it. And maybe media, you know, think of all the developments in indie media, alternative media that happened post-Seattle, for example, and then the whole, you know, amazing developments in IMC and the use of alternative media and those things, they might be a more interesting aspect of a cultural resistance than music at the moment, say.
That's more interesting to a lot of younger people. You know, it's all about apps, gaming, YouTube. You know, they're not interested in music. A lot of obsessed, as we were. That might not be a bad thing, really.
I think there's lots of, you know, sort of going back to the music aspect, there's lots of music out there, countries are shouting, what's the cause of that? But I think that it's got too easy to get out on the internet. I mean, and actually, ironically, it's made it harder to find it. Yeah. We talked about the documentary being hard to find. Mm-hmm. You know, progressivism, I think, in, you know, a very new way, but progressivism, I think, you know, in the playground, that was great. And that's how I found it.
Yeah.
And we're all talking about it. But now, there's so much out there, and it's so easy to get out there, but how do you find it? Mm-hmm. Unless you really work hard, sometimes it just goes under the radar, you have not find it. I think there's a lot of good media being made that's saying lots of stuff about what's wrong with
the world. But going down to the radar then, I mean, for Christ's sake, I mean, not many people came to our gigs, but in comparison to what was going on in the world, you know, because we were totally under the radar. We had no advertising, it was all word of mouth, da da da. It wasn't a big thing. It is now, you know, it's become, it's sort of grown like a snowball going down a mountainside. But it was a small,
What did you want to make when you were in the records? Did you want more people to hear from the records? Because to me, I never got the story, but I got the records, and that's what I started to think. So I didn't want anything. I wanted people to sort of, you know, live their life and make their own choices, you know, and I did everything I could to enable that, whatever I could do.
But I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that nothing's that different. You know, it's so easy to sort of look to these glorious pasts, and it wasn't very much going on. You know, it seemed great to us, and you know, there was little gatherings of punks in every village in Britain, etc., etc., but most of the people were still watching the equivalent of X Factor and, you know, totally supporting nuclear power, etc., etc. It's the same situation. Nothing's really changed.
I just feel that now the gasp has been blown. I think I was talking to Jim earlier, John Galloway's comment on being like sort of respect candidate in Bradford against all the odds. He actually said, I mean, everybody, the media, every political class came out en masse to attack Galloway. Okay, he's a bit flaky, a bit on Big Brother, acted like a cat. But he did say that you can't get a riddle table between three parties now, three main parties. But you can't. This is the reason why I so cheesed off, is because they are essentially three chiefs of the same heart, so three one. And the fact is that there is no distinction. So we can we can get a resolution, 1773, on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, we're bombing the hell out of Libya. And I just feel that, and I don't want to get into start kicking young people either, but it seems to me that as the aggression becomes more overt, more obvious, people just become mute. I'm not talking that there isn't something out there happening, and I think this probably affected the web, and the fact that the voices have dissipated and lost in this worldwide web.
I don't really consider a well place to talk too much about the other young people critically. But
this
conversation seems to be taking a very fertile turn, and we've ended up in a slightly skewed order because the big one there is our time to ask her questions. George has to leave soon. I can see people desperately wanting to get in, so let's chair. I'm feeling a bit useless right now. I do feel we should think about questions directly for George if we can possibly postpone these questions and then come back to them, unless they directly relate to George. Then Sarah, so she can say, which I think will cast some light on this general area where we're talking about how important it is then or whatever.
Can I just say then, and sorry, you want to come in then? All right. And then it's just to pick up a sort of a bit of an overview of that of today, and also perhaps addressing that critical point that you raised too. And then I always make this point. I made it in at least two books, and then I said at conferences as well. We if we have a radical history, we need to take care of it and cherish it, and make sure that future generations understand it and are aware of it. If we don't care enough about it and tell all our stories, and then our successes as well as our failures, and then the glorious and inglorious ones, and then if we don't care enough ourselves to do that, why should anyone else care? And from my perspective, an after pump is historically interesting, and frankly, that's enough for me. I don't need it to feel validated, and to be validated by continuing to have a relevance or an existence in some form, or to still have a practice today, a musical practice. I mean, that doesn't really bother me. It was historically interesting, and then let's have more and more studies that unpack that, that tease out its complexities, its contradictions, and so on, and then put them in a wider political context, and then that draw that out and invite us to make comparisons with our current situation. And that goes not just for anarcho-punk, it goes for road protest in the 90s or the nuclear, the 102 nuclear bases that were set up across the UK in November 1983. 102! That's a big deal. That's a big, big thing to do. Or the Free Festival movement, or, any other Skiffle movement, or CND in the late 50s and stuff like that. Any of those kinds of things. All of those are really, really important because they help for the young generation, which we might slightly awkwardly be, as a father of teenage daughters, we might slightly awkwardly be moving towards saying, yeah, but, in our day, that is a disastrous way to start a sentence with a teenager. Believe me, I've done it. That's the way. Right.
That's part of the point I wanted to make. I wanted to just, much as I'm an old person, wanted to speak out in support of young people. I work with some people who are involved in London Occupy and the UK side of things, and people who are involved in indie media. And there is a lot of activity going on, particularly online, actually, social networking, that is going on kind of behind the scenes from me or from many of us, but there is a lot of activity that's going on. It's not tied to a music scene, it's not tied to a cultural expression that I recognise in terms of it being having a kind of a fashion identity or a cultural identity that I can sort of say, those are the people that are involved in that. But it is going on. So in the same way as you're writing about gardening and whatever, and the guerrilla gardeners and whatever, there's a lot of activity going on that I think we can be dismissive towards, but I think it's there. I know people are involved in the graphics side of it in London Occupy, and I think they're doing some interesting things in the same way as they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't see it as anything different.
I think Rich, you want to kind of quite
a lot. I just sort of wanted to set the record straight a bit with regards to we talk about anarcho-punk as an event kind of thing, and maybe that's been lost for the younger generation. I'm in my mid-40s now and things, and I think the DIY music scene is more fertile, more productive and more energetic than I've ever seen it. I'm constantly amazed and enthralled by the energy, ingenuity and resourcefulness of people 20 years younger than me. And I'm totally encouraged by it.
I think DIY culture has sort of like seeped in sort of into the culture of people, you know, of in their early 20s when they don't, they almost don't have to think about it. You know, it's something there. You know, that alternative economy and a means of expression and ways of communication that maybe as a, you know, kid in the early 20s, I actually had to sort of consciously do something and consciously had to battle with things. So I don't think anarcho-punk's an event that we have to look back on. It's an evolution, if you like, you know. And I think sort of Gordon and people like that and, you know, Jim would totally agree with them.
Russ was saying, I think young people are very active, but I think there's a severe distrust of the media, so I think that dissent has a less public face now, and the activities they're doing are more online, they're more subversive. I mean, you look at a lot of this sort of hacking of institutions, government sites, these are being done by very bright young people through organisations like Anonymous. They're actually meeting out their dissent, but not doing it in a way that the media is going to pick up on it and dilute it and maybe claim it and then twist it and turn it and then make it seem like...
I think the area that's coming up here is really interesting now. I'm sure Penny's got lots of things to say and there'll be further questions. I suggest we now have Sarah's talk, unless anyone has something very, really, really needs to say to George specifically. I'm sure I'm going to say good. Thank you for having...
Quick little bit of thing. There's lots of really interesting talks today, and I'm very glad to come. However, your personal story and the letters you read out actually, to me, was the most interesting bit. And I think a lot of that effect, and it's because it's a personal story. And it's interesting to hear the bigger picture and people talk in terms of overall narratives and so on. But I think the important thing about anarcho-punk is the personal impact, the impact it had on individuals, and how those individuals then turned out and used it in their lives. So I'd like to say thanks for sharing those letters with us. That was fascinating.
Thanks very much, George.